Good afternoon. Today's scripture reading comes from 2 Corinthians 8, 1 through 9. And now, brothers and sisters, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. In the midst of a very severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able, and even beyond their ability. Entirely on their own, they urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in the service to the Lord's people. And they exceeded our expectations. They gave themselves first of all to the Lord, and then by the will of God also to us. So we urge Titus, just as he had earlier made a beginning, to bring also to completion this act of grace on your part. But since you excel in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in complete earnestness, and in the love we have kindled in you, see that you also excel in this grace of giving. I am not commanding you, but I want to test the sincerity of your love by comparing it with the earnestness of others. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. 2 Corinthians 8, 1 through 9, the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Hey, you may be seated, everyone. Hey, good morning. Welcome, everyone. My name is Drew, one of the pastors here. We've been in this message series called Life on the Other Side. And we've been talking about in light of the resurrection, right? Because the people, they witnessed the resurrected Jesus. And fundamentally, their entire worldview and their approach to life fundamentally changes. We talked about hope and riches and power that all of a sudden, these disciples are now, they have this undying kind of hope in this resurrected Jesus. And what does it look like for us then to move and to have our lives transformed in these various facets of our lives? And so Paul is actually writing these letters to the early church. Now I wanted to give you this sense though. Like these letters in the early church, as well as the history in the book of Acts, like this movement is like a small little movement. It's a bunch of nobodies, unschooled, ordinary people. Rome is the power of the day. And so what's happening, I want you to know, it's small potatoes. This is nothing. Paul, like no one thinks that the Christian movement's gonna blow up and expand the way it does. They're being persecuted. They're like some Jewish carpenter, come on now, right? Like so many of us, when we think of movements, we think of like those things that are happening that are important and worthwhile and world-changing. We think of Manhattan. This is where it would start, right here in Midtown, you know? But I just think like there's a small little movement starting in like Staten Island or something. And you were like, come on, there's nothing. Come on. The best restaurants aren't there. The world changing people, it's Manhattan. That's where it is. And then Brooklyn, then Queens. And then the Bronx. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know why I did that ranking right there. That was very unkind of me. Nonetheless. I mean, this is basically what we think about, though, when we think about, but like this movement is like this nothing movement, okay? So even these letters, that yes, it's the scriptures that we read today, but if you could almost imagine as these letters are being written, this is a small little house church movement, unschooled, ordinary people. And in this season, though, it's a season called Eastertide, life on the other side. It's how is this resurrection movement going to begin? Because in many ways, what's written here are actually kind of written documents that inform and that have informed the church for hundreds and thousands of years. And so here we are today living in light of this Eastertide season. Jesus is resurrected from the grave. Now, the letter that was read earlier, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, it's a letter that Paul writes. Paul had this radical conversion himself from being this persecutor of Christians to becoming this ardent follower of Jesus, who's now telling other people to follow Jesus. Now, Paul has started different churches in different cities. This is what he would do. He would help start a church. They'd start a movement of house churches. Then he would move on to these other churches in different cities, start these churches. And then what he would do is he would write letters to these different churches to keep in touch with them, as well as to let them know and to teach them about what it means to follow Jesus. Now, as Paul's writing these letters, this is the second letter to the church in Corinth. And as he writes this letter to the church in Corinth, and it's possible that he wrote other letters to the church in Corinth, but this letter that he writes, to give some context, he's actually asking the church in Corinth, he's giving them a picture of like, a financial collection is being taken. And they're trying to take this financial collection amongst the different churches to help support poorer believers in Jerusalem. So do you get this picture then? As he's writing this letter, he's trying to encourage the church in Corinth. Can you give financially to support this other church and this other group of believers in Jerusalem? Now, the way that he does it, as he gives this background, like he's basically in chapters 8 and chapter 9, he's writing this letter to real people. Now, notice what he writes. He says, "And now, brothers and sisters, we want you to know about the grace." Can I hear you say grace? That's right. Grace is this word that becomes so central to Christian faith. And you'll see it appear again and again. Grace is unmerited favor, getting a gift we don't deserve. And basically he says, I want you to know about this grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. Now, some of you might be like, where's Macedonia? What is that referring to? In northern Greece, there were three cities primarily, but there's obviously that entire region. But in these three cities, like Berea, Philippi, so Paul's letter to the church in Philippians is called Philippians. Thessalonica, Paul's letter to the church of in Thessalonians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. These are letters written to actual people. And so this region then of northern Greece is Macedonia. And see, what Paul is basically doing is he's writing to this church in Corinth, and he's basically like, hey, listen, let me tell you about what's happening in Macedonia. This grace that they've been given. Check this out. Look at what he says. He says, in the midst of a very severe trial. Now, severe trial. If you were to look at the book of Acts or in some of the different letters, whether it's in Philippians or in Thessalonians, of these churches in Macedonia, what you realize is that this area of Macedonia, intense persecution was the norm for the early Christians. They were being thrown in prison. Some of them were being put to death. So this idea then, basically, he's basically saying, listen, I want to talk about this grace that God has given the churches in Macedonia. But this is how he starts. He's basically like, first, they were going through a very severe trial. And you're like, oh, seriously? What's that about? And notice what he says. Their overflowing joy. What? Wait a minute. They're going through trial, but yet they're filled with joy. And then look at what he says. And their extreme poverty. I mean, are you on this roller coaster? You're like, what? Wait, which one is it? Severe trial. But they're joyful in the midst of this. But they're in extreme poverty. And the word for poverty is like, it's like being a beggar. They're like beggars. Now, again, the early churches is snuffed out, smaller. Like the Roman Empire is the big, powerful military, economic engine. The church is nothing. And what he's saying is, listen, these people, they're going through severe trial, but they're filled with joy. They're in extreme poverty, but it wells up in rich generosity. What? Now, what is rich generosity? This word for generosity is actually a word that it actually means simple, kind of like a simple liberality to it. It's like this, like, it's not like life is so complicated, but these people in the midst of joy and sorrow and persecution and trial and extreme poverty, like beggars, they have such a simple generosity to them. And in the midst of complicated life, in the midst of them being at the end of their rope, there's such a simple way that their spirits are so generous, even financially. And look what he writes. For I testify that they gave financially as much as they were able, and even beyond their ability. Wow. He's saying, like, don't you see? Like, hey, I just want to give you this picture, church in Corinth. These churches in Macedonia, they're persecuted. They're like beggars. But I want you to know something in them. There was a grace that was given to them that when they encountered God, it actually began to change the fabric of their lives so much that they begin to be generous. They don't live out of scarcity. They're actually generous. And it's this simple-minded generosity in the midst of what could be a very complicated kind of position that they're in. Now, here's the thing. Most of us, we think, oh, you know, the people who are called to be generous are the people who have all the money. Those are the people who should be generous. Not me when I live in Queens or whatever, right? Like, it's those people, the people who live around this neighborhood in Midtown Manhattan. But not me. But notice what Paul is giving this example, and he's giving the example, the most extreme case of a people who are in poverty. They're in poverty and they're struggling and they're being persecuted and they're like beggars. And Paul's like, no, that's the example. These churches, though, There's such a simple generosity to them. In fact, they didn't even just give, but they gave above and beyond what anyone might expect. Now, notice Paul doesn't actually, he doesn't give the exact dollar figure that they gave, because it's not even about the dollar figure. He's talking about the posture of a people who feel like they have nothing. And he's like, even then, they're filled with this incredible generosity financially. Now, here's the thing. It's not only the church in Macedonia. See, this whole thing, right? Like when it comes to spiritual growth and spiritual renewal, most of us, whenever we think about spiritual renewal, we think of, oh, it's my prayer life that gets transformed. Or, oh, it's the way that I can begin to share my faith or the way that I begin to treat other people. Now, all of those things are essential. And all of that is what happens in the early church. But notice, there's this other part about spiritual vitality and spiritual renewal that Paul is referencing here that had always marked the early church. Look at what it says in the book of Acts, in the historical account in the book of Acts. Here's what it says, right? The Holy Jesus ascends to heaven, resurrected. He ascends to heaven, and then the Holy Spirit, God's presence comes upon the people, and it changes fundamentally the fabric of human history. People have these incredible experiences, signs and wonders and healing. And many of us, whenever we think of spiritual work, that's what we think of. Spiritual work is signs and wonders and healing and power. But look at what happens in the early church. It says all the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything that they had. Whoa, this is also what's happening in revival, in renewal. He says, with great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. And notice what happens. And God's grace was so powerfully at work in them, in them all, that there were no needy persons among them. For from time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales, and put it at the apostles' feet. And it was distributed to anyone who had need. Wow. What? See, what's happening in the midst of all this spiritual renewal, tongues of fire, people speaking in different languages, healings happening. What happens is it actually begins to change the fabric of the way that people approach money. And they actually become more generous. Now, notice, this passage isn't saying, you know what, this is basically arguing for the government is arguing for a certain kind of economic system where this would be. No, it doesn't say that. It's simply describing the phenomenon of whenever someone experiences true spiritual vitality, it always leads and is marked by unusual generosity. In other words, what it means for me to encounter, to have this experience, like some of us, and here's the reality, some of us might be like, Jesus, you could have all of me. Take everything. I would die for you. What? You want? Actually, but this account, that's mine. Like, this is my hard-earned cash here. I don't want to give this kind of money. I mean, isn't it true? This is what we do. We basically will say, Jesus, you can have everything. Change my life. Give me hope, a living hope. That's the passage that I want to cling to like last week. And here, we're like, actually, what happens after the resurrection is people are actually able to go from a scarcity mentality to actually incredible generosity. And one of the marks of that is your money. And now some of us are like, well, wait, why are you being so personal? I can't believe it. This church, I knew it. Just like all these other churches, all they want is your money. But here, the marks of spiritual vitality, it affects every part of your life. And the reality is one of the hardest parts for it to affect for you and for me and all of us is your money, your hard-earned cash. Now, here's what's so stunning. Look at what Jesus says about money. Jesus says, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now, as I was reflecting on this thing, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. You know, I was thinking like most of us, when we think about money and generosity, we often think it's the other way around. Where your heart is, there your treasure is, right? This is what we think. You know what? You will give to what you're compassionate about, where your heart is. Where you feel generous, that's where you'll give to. Isn't it interesting that Jesus doesn't say that? Now, why doesn't he say that? Why? Because if I were to ask any single one of you, if we were to have coffee today, we were just to sit down and we were just doing a temperature check around money and finances, and I were to ask you, how's this, you know, going? I think every single one of us, no matter what your station is in life, what your role is, how much money you make, every single one of us would be like, no, I want to be a generous person. That's so part of my heart. Like, I want to be generous. It's just that life is really difficult in the city. My social life, when it comes to these expenses, when it comes to living expense, like, this is what we would say. In other words, your heart, every single one of us would be like, yeah, I want to be generous. But notice what Jesus is saying. He's like, no. Let me tell you what. Where your money is, that's actually where your heart is. Do you see the difference? He's basically saying, why? Because there are receipts. Because every single one of us has good intentions, especially when it comes to generosity and how we use our money. Every single one of us are like, no, I'm more generous than that person over there. I totally know that. I'm more generous than those people who work in finance or whatever it might be. I'm more generous than, this is what we do. We justify ourselves. And meanwhile, here's what Jesus is saying. No. Actually, where you, where your treasure is, that's where your heart is. And there are receipts. Just check your bank account. Why? Because money reveals your values. Every single one of us, I'm sure, has a beautiful heart towards generosity. We say this generosity liturgy. I so want that to be true about me. But at the end of the day, where is your cold, hard cash? Where does your money go? Because your money reveals your values. Now, here's what I recognize. Some of you are like, well, Drew, you're coming kind of strong about this. Like, I can't believe this pastor. Why is he talking to me this way? Listen, I've always said, whenever we talk about money here, and you know, I give the same kind of explanation every time. I don't want any money from you. Some of you are like, oh, that pastor, he wants money for himself so that he can enrich himself. And I've always told you, my salary relative to other pastors in Manhattan is half to a quarter of what most pastors in Midtown Manhattan make. Now, how am I able to live? It's because my wife is financially, she's independently wealthy. There, I said it, okay? So listen, I've always told you all, like, listen, I'm not preaching this because I need your money. I don't need your money. I got my wife's money. I don't need your money. So if you think I'm preaching this and I'm coming on strong, Jesus preaches about this so freely. Why? Because you know it as I do. Your money. So many of us might be like, God, you can have everything of mine. Change my prayer life. But how about your cold, hard cash? How about your money? And some of us were like, well, if you saw my receipts, so you don't understand like what I make at work and how much, you know, I might be in debt and all this. There's all sorts of ways. Even right now, you're probably like, if you were to compare like what I spend on and things like that compared to other people, like this is what we do. We justify ourselves. And why does Jesus say where your treasure is, that's where your heart is? He's basically saying the last frontier, oftentimes when it comes to the spiritual life, is your money. And we have receipts. And the question is, where's your money going? Now, you might say, like, oh, well, it's not you, Drew. You don't want my, okay, your wife is independently wealthy, whatever. It's the church. The church is wealthy. Listen, I want you to know, like, our church last year, our little church, we gave close to $500,000 away to outside organizations. And we purchased a building that 80% of the time it's used by organizations outside of us, saving them up to $200,000 in savings to rent a comparable space in Midtown Manhattan. So listen, I'm just saying to you, our church, we're doing our best as well to live into this value of generosity as part of the ecosystem of the city. But the reality is your money reveals your values. And the reality is most of us, we say, oh, no, the giving, it's for those rich people. And the reality is most of us, though, especially in a city like this, even if we make above the median, we're like, we're not as rich as those people. And those people are the people who should be giving. But notice Paul's giving this example. He's giving an example of a church in trial, persecution, in poverty, like beggars. And he's basically saying, don't you, the beautiful story of this kind of rich, simple kind of generosity. Is that true of you? And is that true of me? Your money reveals your values. Now, listen, as an immigrant kid, money is like, I realize, like, every time I preach on this, I have to do a temperature check of myself. Like, God, the receipts are there, so I'll review. Where are our expenses going? Where's our saving going? Where's our investing going? But most of all, where's our generosity? Are we living into this value of what it means to be generous first? And it's not just me, it's all of us. And this whole idea, like, I realized, like, I, again, coming from this immigrant background, you know, for our sabbatical, we're going to go visit my family in California. So I just want you to know, like, I, for the last 60 days, I've had my Google Flights track price on for flights to California. And so basically every single morning after I've spent some time praying, I will basically check my Google Flights and see whether the price has gone down for how much I'm going to spend for these flights for us to go to California. And so I do this kind of like nonstop, checking the flights. And so I ended up buying the tickets because I thought it was at its lowest price, but then I saw that it went even lower. So I canceled that flight, got the refund, and then rebought the flights at a lower amount and got some credit. Yes, thank you, everyone. I felt very proud myself. Incredible. And so I remember telling Tina, I'm like, Tina, I found cheaper flights. She's like, really? That's, I'm really proud of you. You do that like every morning. And I'm like, yeah, I did. She's like, how much do we save? I'm like, $10. Save $10. Aren't you proud of me? And she's like, you know, the time you invest in like just checking that and checking across different flights and the Google flights, like to save $10, like you probably could have made that money another way, like with all the hours that you put in. So I just want you to know, like, listen, this is my background. I'm like, and right now there's just this moment, this my own kind of like the spiritual vitality of my own soul. Am I willing to let go and say, God, I entrust this to you because all of it is yours? And what Paul is basically saying is like, don't you see? Here's a story of this church. Now, Paul gives another case though for what does generosity look like and what are the features of what generosity look like? Look at what he says. He says, so we urge Titus, just as he had earlier made a beginning, to bring also to completion this act of grace on your part. In other words, here he is, financial propriety. There's a third party who's going to check how much is there. We all know the person's name. We will figure out, like, how are the checks and balances working when it comes to how we properly handle our money. To bring also to completion this act of grace on your part. But since you excel in everything, again, your heart, when it comes to your faith, your speech, in knowledge, in complete earnestness, and in the love we have kindled in you, see that it goes that final step, that you actually also excel in this grace of giving. That you're not just saying like, oh yes, my heart is there with you, Jesus, but it's also begun to touch your bank account. And he says, I'm not commanding you, but I want to test the sincerity of your love by comparing it with the earnestness of others. Now, there's this fine line because, again, Paul is not commanding people. He's not trying to shame them. He's just saying, listen, what I want to do is I just want you to take a step back. I want you to look at what's happening in this larger story of what God is doing. And I want you to know this larger story. And then throughout chapters 8 and chapter 9, for instance, he talks about don't give out of compulsion. He says, give out of the grace that's been given to you. I'm not commanding you. Now, he's walking this fine line between sharing the story of these people who are impoverished in a worldly sense, and yet they're giving. And he's giving this example, and he's basically saying, like, I just want to give you a picture. Why? It's this picture of how all of us, every single one of us, we play a part in generosity. Every single person participates in what we do. Now, the reality is, though, some people might say, no, it's just for those people who have those kinds of means to be able to support. But what Paul is doing is like, no, it doesn't even matter where you are in your station of life. You could be a student. You could be an artist. You can be someone who maybe you don't have a lot to contribute. But don't you see? The story of what God does is that every single one of us, we all participate. And the churches in Macedonia are evidence of this. Out of their own scarcity, they give generously. And so he's making this case, and he's doing so by basically saying each one of us is encouraged to participate in generosity. He's trying to give us a window, like a view of the vast world and the way that the economy of God works, is that each one of us, hopefully, having been changed by God's grace, We give in a generous way, each one of us. Now, as I was thinking about our church community, I was thinking about like just the history of our church. I was just thinking about like, what, like, how could I tell the story of our church community? Because the reality is, many of you, you weren't around in those beginning days. Some of you may or may not know, but we actually started our church actually across the street in a building that's no longer there. And so I thought I'd actually share with you a couple of pictures. Here's a picture of our launch team who started our church on Roosevelt Island. Now, some of you actually ran a 4K at Roosevelt Island to support an organization called Do For One, an organization that was birthed out of our church community and that helps connect people with physical and mental disabilities to those in friendship with those who are able-bodied and minded. So this organization that was birthed, you see Andrew Oliver, who's the founder of that organization, there he is sitting in the middle of that group. Now, most people, when they think about new churches that start, they think, oh yeah, churches, the way that they start is you got to get young people who are cool and hip and they've got to have a vibe to them. And I just want you to know, this was our vibe on Roosevelt Island. The person on the right, his name is Uncle Jim Bates. He was one of the founding members of our church from the very beginning of our church in Astoria. He was the president of the Roosevelt Island Disabled Association. And then the person on the left is Dolores Green, who was the president of the Senior Association on Roosevelt Island. And these were the founders of our church on Roosevelt Island. Now, Uncle Jim actually helped start the church in Astoria as well. He was one of the most faithful. He showed up week in and week out, gave generously, financially, so that our church in those early days could make it. Now, Uncle Jim actually passed away a few years ago, as did Dolores Green. None of you, or very few of you, I should say, have probably met Uncle Jim. But do you realize, like, in many ways, the reason why we're here in this room and we have air conditioning is because of generosity of people who have gone before. Like, people like Uncle Jim Bates, who believed in the mission of God. His story continues to live on, and in Do For One, as the organization has flourished and grown, it's because of folks like Uncle Jim Bates. Here's another picture. Here's a picture of where our Midtown church started. It was at Turtle Bay Music School, which was actually diagonal from here. And we met in this school that you could only fit about 100 people down in the basement. It had this red door. It was this historic music school that ended up getting sold and knocked down. And we met in this basement space. Here's our sign that's there. Here's a picture from one of the first services at our space there. You can see we had purple lights. Really cool. And you can see me. I had a lot more hair. Now, Craig Okpala, who actually is leading worship, he actually is the lead pastor of Hope Jersey City now, which has now turned into one of the largest churches in downtown Jersey City. And he's one of my closest friends. And some of those folks are also part of that Jersey City team as well. Here's a picture of Tina and David. My son David is now 13 years old. That was him in 2014, so he's 2 years old there. You know, people, whenever they see pictures of Tina, they're like, wow, she looks exactly the same. And then I'm like, what about me? And people are like, yeah, she looks exactly the same. I'm like, okay. Here's a picture of one of the early services. We were like kind of testing out what we would do. And we used to turn off all the lights. And we turned off all the lights. We had this, again, these lights that would go. But we would turn off all of them because we wanted the focus to be on God. But it was really weird. And people were so like, they're kind of spooked out. They're like, what's going on? And we're like, oh, we want to be a faceless people worshiping a beautiful God. And so we've gone the exact opposite. We actually have no lights anymore. Maybe we should throw up a couple, but now it's more about just the presence of God and wanting to seek God. But I just look back at these pictures and I'm like, we thought we were so cool. You know, what's interesting is that Jenny, who's leading worship there, she actually helps lead worship at Joy Manhattan now, a church in the city, a marvelous church in the city. Alan Thomas, who's actually on the electric guitar, which, again, you can't see any of their faces, but believe me, Alan actually was an intern with us. He's now the lead pastor of a thriving kind of 3,000-person church in San Antonio, Texas. Craig Okpala, like I mentioned, to actually help start Hope Jersey City, and we sent them money and we sent people to help start that church. They've started a counseling center that has boomed in Jersey. It's been amazing. The generosity of these people who so deeply, who you may or may not meet. Jeff Pan, who's on the keys, he actually helped start a church over in Los Angeles that we ended up helping start a church that's actually thriving in the West LA region. Here's a picture from one of those early services. It's a picture of Daryl Romano, everyone. Daryl, who's sitting right here in the third row. Daryl Romano, he was part of our prayer team in those early days. And you can see he's actually praying with Ricardo as well. Ricardo and Deanna Santos, they were founding members of our church community. Ricardo passed away 2 years ago, and there was a marvelous celebration for him. Many of you have never met Ricardo. You've probably seen Deanna, because she comes pretty regularly whenever she's able with some of her health challenges, and she's a beloved part of our community. But I look back at this picture. Daryl was actually, he was on the leadership team very early on of this church, volunteering. He still leads a small group in the Upper East Side, along with Steve and Sue. And Daryl, you've just been an incredible gift throughout the years. He was part of the original church in Astoria as well. Here he is, just praying. Now, most of you probably aren't aware of the legacy of his, of this man's life in our church community. And as I was just thinking about our church, the many people who have sown deeply, and the reason why we have the hub, the reason why we have locations in Westside and East Village, is because of the generosity of people who have gone before us. And everyone gets to participate. And this call, this invitation for you to participate financially is an opportunity for you to be part of the story of others who will be blessed, hopefully with air conditioning too, in future years. And listen, I'm leaving this summer. This goes beyond me as well. Hopefully, if the gospel keeps working, which I'm sure it does, what it does is there's people, faces, names, people who continue to sow, and as a result of their generosity, we get to benefit and enjoy. Here's a picture of our first Christmas party in 2014 as we are building our Midtown church. There's actually a picture of Mike and Jeannie Park, who they actually met because one of the founding members of Hope Midtown was actually moving to California and had a wedding in California. So I was officiating that wedding. Jeannie, who was one of our small group leaders, Jeannie Choi at the time, we were going out with a group of Hope people. As we're going out, I'm like, Jeannie's an amazing person. So I called up my friend Mike, who lived in San Francisco, or lived in Los Angeles, and I was like, Mike, there's a woman here that you should meet. And he said, what's her name? And they met, they fell in love, and then he moved back here. Fell in love and got married. I like that story. And they ended up starting this church in Westside. And now our Westside community is starving because of their commitment and investment. And I look at these many names and faces. At that same Christmas party, here's another picture. Daryl Romano again, everyone. During our White Elephant gift exchange, he won a book called How to Meet Women on the Subway. What's that? You burnt, yeah. It burnt a lot of Metro cards after that. Is that what you said? Now, what's funny is that this woman that's right behind him, I think that was her only time visiting, and she was probably like, these churches, these people, they give gifts like this, you know? I never saw her again. Some of you are like, there's a title like that? You're Googling it right now. Stop that. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, you should Google it. No, I'm just kidding. But I just think of like these stories and generosity and people who have given and so deeply. People have moved on. You know, in the last 3 weeks, I've had 7 different couples tell me that they're leaving the city, moving on to different places. Some of them in leadership in our church community. And it's been this brutal moment of like, oh, like the heartbreak. But it's also a moment of joy because I know I have these friends from around the world. And each one of them, like the ways that they've invested in our community. And I know that you all may not know them, but because of their generosity, like we're here. And from all these years that Hope has been around, the whopping 10 years, like It's because of the generosity of many people who have gone before. And everyone is invited to participate. Because this is how the family of God works. And you might be like, no, well, I'm on the spectrum of like, I don't have a lot to give. And Paul's basically saying like, look at the church, and the Macedonian church. And others of you, maybe you make a lot and you're like, I don't know if I could give that much, because if I give that much, I don't know what's going to do to this. I'm just telling you, like, listen, everyone gets to participate. And it's the invitation of God that each one of us would be like, yeah, I can be part of that. I want to be part of investing and in blessing the next generation. Look at what Paul writes. He writes, entirely on their own, they urgently pleaded. This is the same word in other translations that's used for begged. I just want you to know, the Macedonian churches who were persecuted and were in poverty, they just begged that they could have the privilege of sharing. That's crazy. And they exceeded our expectations. They gave themselves first of all to the Lord, and then by the will of God also to us. Now, how in the world does that happen? How could a people who go from, like, in a worldly sense, have so much scarcity, be people who are welled up in this simple, overflowing generosity? Look at what Paul writes. Second to last slide. He says, for you know the grace, there's that word again, grace, the gift of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor. Do you see what Paul is doing? He's using the same language of Jesus that he described these people. Like, they're people who are beggars. But don't you see, that's Jesus' story. Though he was rich, he became poor. So that through his becoming a beggar, you might inherit his richness. Now, how in the world can someone with such scarcity, with such limited supply, with such persecution, well up in generosity? How? It's that these people felt rich. They felt full of joy. They had this living hope. They felt this power. They felt this grace. They're not poor. They're rich. Now, wait a minute, Drew. They're not rich. They're below the poverty line. And it's like, no. Don't you see? Their richness is not dependent on what's in their bank account. Their hope, their power, their joy, their peace, their grace is something that the world cannot give. And the world can't take it away. And because they themselves are filled with this hope, this joy, this power, this peace, this grace, whatever situation they're in, they're able to flow. It impacts every part of their lives, including their money. Now, here's what St. Augustine says. St. Augustine, when he talks about grace, he says, God gives where he finds empty hands, where he finds the kinds of people that whatever station in life, you might have a lot of money, you might have a little, but the kind of people who just have empty hands, who are able to surrender it all to God and say, God, you are the one who has made me rich and joyful and full of grace you have given to me. Grant me the kind of heart to be surrendered to you, to be generous with what I've been given, so that I can actually begin to mirror the kind of rich, simple generosity that you have had for me. This is the invitation of the Christian life and the Christian story. To open our hands and say, God, I want more of your grace. I need your grace. I surrender it all to you. Give me a joy, a hope, a peace, a power, a grace that the world can't give me and the world can't take away.